myself that took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
All right, lads, so we finally have some good news. It's great to do a live show today because the GAA are about to release their return to play roadmap. And this has been agreed by the COVID-19 advisory group, and it's going to be ratified by the GAA management. So we're going to see this roadmap either tomorrow or Monday at the latest. So Damien Lawler on the RTE website gave us a taste of it yesterday. So he obviously got a leak. He has some sources in the GAA, and I wouldn't doubt his sources because he's obviously very well in with the GAA. So what he had yesterday is that the club football is going to start back on Friday the 31st. Well, I don't think he had Friday the 31st. That's the information I got. Friday the 31st of July. So we're going to see club action in August, September, and we're going to see intercounty action in October and November. We're going to see club action until county final stage, and that's it. And then we're going to see intercounty until All-Ireland stage at the end of November. So I don't know, lads, I'm absolutely delighted. There's light at the end of the tunnel. This is fantastic news, and I'm starting on a positive light, and I'm not going to start giving out yet, Conan.
is this brilliant? it's really good. It's almost like you stumbled across a really good format where you play the club championship and then after that you go into the county championship, and like that, it's like a classic like back in the day. It's like, you know, if you play well in your club then you get into your county, and like it almost means more then when you go into the semi-final because you're going to look is who can we call up to the county. I know that's not going to happen, they already have their panels and stuff, but yeah, no, it's exciting. Like, and it's class that it's going to be condensed. It's not going to be a 4-month season for club and county every year, but it's going to make it really exciting this year, I think.
Yeah, so the pitches are going to open up on June 29th. So this is a change from John Horan's July 20th. So the advisory group has got hold. Like, this needs to be pointed out that, well, first we'll talk about the June 29th, lads. So, Conor, you've 4 weeks prep on the field with the ball. Probably enough, right?
Yeah, I would have thought.
Not ideal. Not like the perfect scenario for me would be June the 8th pitches back open, June 29th ramp up training a little bit, you know, to more shadow matches, and then, you know, July 20th let's start playing. That's what the government allowed, but based on John Horan's kind of ultra conservative July 20th date, to pull it back by 3 weeks, the advisory group at least got some wriggle room on that silly date John Horan pulled out of his hat.
Yeah, so if we're allowed back in the pitches on 29th of June, you're looking at maybe 4 weeks running the championship. That'd be correct.
If
we can drill down into the minutiae of it, it's not entirely ideal. I mean, like, you probably want a longer preseason than that. But I go back to a point that I think I made a couple of weeks ago when you're talking about like match fitness and stuff like that, is that everybody is coming from the same place, or at least they should be coming from the same place if they were observing the guidelines. So it's not as if you're playing in a club championship and, you know, one team has been doing 6 weeks extra training or anything like that, everybody will be back in, you know, come like the last couple of days in June, preparing for a return, you know, for the last week in July. So I suppose that, like, the main thing you'd want to look out for is that, I suppose, the type of training that clubs are going to do before they come back, because obviously, again, if people have been, you know, adhering to the guidelines, they wouldn't have been able to do the match based stuff, you know, that you need to do. So there'll be a lot of that, and, you know, it'll be up, it'll be incumbent on strength and conditioning coaches and managers and coaches and stuff like that, just to the avoidance of injury, I think, will be really important to, like, considering the activity that we've had the last few weeks. But I think everybody will be just so delighted, Willie, to get some sort of return to action that they'll, you know, they'll take 4 weeks if they're given it.
Right. And, like, I mean, the thing it's not 4 weeks, you know, starting back in January when you have a bit of a belly on you and stuff. Like, players know now 4 weeks before the 29th what's happening. So they should be, you know, have cardiovascular fitness pretty well sorted. They should be doing shuttle sprints on their own. They should be doing as much ball work as they can. and even in smaller groups on a public pitch. And when you hit the June 29th, Conan, when you're heading back to group training, physically you're in very good shape, and 4 weeks with the ball, realistically, you know, it's not ideal because we don't know what the story with challenge matches. You know, can you do that? I doubt it. Can you play? You'll probably be able to play some, you know, less contact games. You see, the problem with this 4 weeks, Conan, is the first 2 weeks might be no contact and just small groups. And then the second 2 weeks might be ramping it up. That's why I reckon the GAA got it so wrong with this July 20th opening pitches. They got it arseways. And instead of opening up walkways now in the next phase on June the 8th, they should be opening back to pitches and gradually building it up over the 8 weeks. Do you know what I mean? Rather than 4 weeks, July 29th, you have to ramp training up to, you know, start a championship match a month later. You pretty much want to be starting a good bit of contact in week two.
I think you're right, though, when you say like, you're not coming in with a belly. It's not January or December or whatever. And, like, to be honest, everybody had done a pre-seasons, and I don't know about anybody else, but, like, it'd be less likely that you want to have lost all that work that you'd done pre-season. You probably lost some of it, but basically all you could do for the last 11 weeks is run. So part of me was thinking that people will be coming in with a better cardiovascular fitness than probably normal. Like, I haven't turned in 11 weeks. I was never good at turning, so I need to start doing that. Like, and you're talking about shoulder runs. There's little things like that you'll have to find, Jim. But I think it's just a much higher base that you're coming into. And even if it is starting in June 29th and not June 8th, like you had proposed, it's still enough time to get to a reasonable standard, because I think everybody has been training or they have been running. And like you say, you have 4 weeks now as well before you go back for another 4 weeks.
The funny thing is, the date of July 29th to start back club activity, it's only 9 days later than the government pathway, which is the 20th of July that GAA games can start. So there's no real complaint on that. The problem is the build-up to it has been done so shoddily and arseways that it just doesn't seem like a proper kind of lead into it. So we know John Horan says July the 20th to reopen pitches. And this was said completely unchallenged on the Sunday game. And the interesting thing about this, lads, because this was a statement was released about this. And obviously on the same statement that there was an advisory group set up. So it almost looked like in the statement, the advisory group, which has medical experts on it, has GPA representatives, you know, has different representatives from the GAA. It made it look like that advisory group was involved in that 20th of July date. And it wasn't. Like, they came in, you know, with their hands tied in a lot of ways, in that they had to work towards a date that they wouldn't necessarily have chosen. So, like, I mean, it was a total botch job, the July 20th date, by County Board Chairman and GAA Management Committee with no medical expertise, and pulled this out of nowhere. And, you know, like, they finally got to, the advisory group has obviously got their hands on it, got them back to play only 9 days after the, you know, the 20th of July, which was the government recommendation to go back playing. But, you know, they obviously weren't able to talk around, you know, opening the pitches any earlier, which for me, the pitches should be opened in, you know, on the 8th and then, you know, built up from there, rather than, I think we're getting walkways on the 8th. Like, it's, you know, it just doesn't make sense, but you couldn't make it up, a lot of that stuff. But isn't it interesting that July 20th date was just made up without consulting the actual advisory group, which maybe it was set up after that date was pulled out and said, OK, here you go, medical experts. Here's a date you have to work towards that we just decided on a group call with a lot of county board chairmen.
Yeah, like I think I said at the time, William, and granted, this going back maybe 3 or 4 weeks, that the GAA was buying itself some time. And then, like, you look at the reaction to the interview that John Horan did, and like for the few days afterwards, you know, he seemed to be getting, I know you had some issues with it at the time, but he seemed to be getting a lot of praise. But things just move on so quickly, and there's an anxiousness, there's an anxiety about people to move on, you know, so quickly, like, and to get to resume some sort of normality. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I would say the only thing to come out of it, like, at the time, maybe they were trying to buy themselves some time, and, you know, hopefully the data will have moved on, so by the end of July that they'd be in a better position. But it's moved on so quickly now. But the only positive thing is that they said they'd review it as they went on, and they are reviewing it as they go on. And now it looks like, you know, it probably was a mistake at the time, but at least now they're willing to correct it, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose if they just followed the government advice, you know, it would have been clearer. But there, of course, the club is getting 2 months, Conan, and the Intercounty is getting 2 months, and there's some people are still not happy. Here's a tweet I saw. I won't say who wrote it, but this is a flavour of a lot of tweets I saw on this same subject, and it's the same old nonsense. For the club, the beginning for one season of provincial and Ireland championships is another blow to a grade already feeling squeezed in the calendar. For 1 year, why not give club priority to club competitions instead of inter-county games being played back in October? Lack of respect. So they're all given out. For once in the history of the Gaelic Athletic Association, club football is getting the identical window that inter-county football is getting. And people are whinging about this because they want to finish out the whole year to a finish. The reality is the club season is entirely longer than what this new inter-county condensed season is going to be. You can't be any fairer than 2 months and 2 months. And we still have, what about the club player?
Yeah, but you're giving half of it to what's only 1% of the county. I don't know, like sometimes I feel like a bit of a turncoat.
Financially, they need it, though. Jesus, Conan, what are they going to do?
Just joking. Plus, it's like, it's, you know, the majority of people, like, you know, who don't play, and actually the majority of people don't play in the GAA, they don't play. They watch, and they probably prefer watching the county, like, you know, because it's a higher standard, and it's better marketed and better covered. But sometimes I feel like a turncoat when I'm going against the club stuff, because, you know, I know it's hip to bang on, like to bang that drum and yeah, to make that point, like, oh, only 2 months for club, a typical GAA. But like, I play club, Connor plays club, you still play club, like, you still get plenty of games. Like, you know, I know it's annoying sometimes that you want to know when you're playing and stuff like that, but you play, like, in Dublin, you start in February, you play 15 league games, you go into a championship in April, you play championships in September. Like, there's loads of matches still, like, and as a club player, I personally, I've never felt that screwed over by it. Like, you know, and again, that makes me a bit of a turncoat. But, you know, especially now when it's 2 months for club and 2 months for inter-county, and we had thought that going into county first would have made more sense. I don't get what we're talking about, because club is going on first, and like, that's going to be the one that everybody's getting the focus on. They're getting the train earlier. The county will probably have to take a back seat. The county managers will be raging about that. And it's going to be harder to control, because there's so many club teams, so many club players. It just would have been more natural to go on with the county first, because it's more control.
Yeah, but no, I was actually thinking about that. And the reason that they can't go inter-county first is because they wouldn't be able to with the government travel restrictions. Do you get me? Like, the 20-kilometer restriction will be there. So in October, November, that, you'd imagine that will have gone. But within,
but I think that goes in July 20th.
The end of July,
sure, is it not August 10th that the travel restrictions go? No.
No, phase four, you're allowed to go beyond your 20 kilometers.
You can go beyond 20 kilometres. Oh, well, then we were right. Okay, I'm actually disproving myself with false information. So maybe I should have read that properly. But in a funny way, lads, some pitches could open now. Like, John Fogarty had some stats at the Examiner. And we know that Sligo, for the last 15 days, it's 16 now since I read this, Kerry for the last 12 days, Wexford for the last 12 days, Donegal for the last 12 days, have had no new cases. You know, like, I mean, what is stopping those counties getting back to normal, you know, going out on their pitches, playing? It's not like, we know that it's pretty much wiped out of the community now. If you've no new cases for over a week, surely you're treated different than, you know, Dublin, for example, which I know the cases are minuscule in Dublin now, but or Cork or any of the big urban kind of cities, that it's a lot. There's basically minimal risk in those counties. And they, for me, they should be allowed back. And another thing, they're not really getting a leg up on anyone else, because they're only going to play in their own local county championship anyways. Do you get me? And the inter-county players, you could say that's unfair, they'll be back before. But sure, all inter-county players will have had 2 months of club football before they start back. Do you know what I mean? I don't know, Conan. I don't see why there would be any reason why different county boards can't decide it for themselves.
Yeah, well, there's just, like, remember Leo Varadkar was on before talking about, you know, if a restaurant in Roscommon opens, everyone goes down. Not that everyone's going to land down to Guido's pits in Donegal, but does it become that sort of thing where when you see other clubs training and other counties are getting back to normal,
I don't know what it's like for you, but if there's a pitch open in Offaly, a team from Leash can't just land down and say, here, lads, we have a ball here, can we join in?
I know that's what I'm saying, but like, you know, but then once you see that in Leash, do you not just think, oh, fuck that, like, we're going back as well, like, you know, it's all fine, let's just do it, we'll be smart about it, you know, and then it just once you hear one club at least doing it, then everybody else is definitely in Leash going to start doing it. It just has a sort of a knock-on effect.
No, one club in Leash, it would be all clubs in Leash. If Leash has had no new cases, you know, for whatever it is, 14 days, you know, every club in Leash then should be allowed to go back.
Yeah, but if you look at, like, you see Bowes training, the video of the League of Ireland team, they were out training there in some Dublin park, and, you know, they got caught. Like, they said that they had been managing it, and there were groups of four, but this time they had an extra group of four, which was a mistake. And I was wondering then about the reaction of other League of Ireland teams when they see that, where they were thinking, oh, Jesus, well, they're training, we better start doing something a bit more crap. Like, just again, it goes into that psyche then. Like, you start thinking, they're getting ahead of us, we better get ahead.
Yeah, that's the thing. But again, I make the point, Connor, in that they're not really getting ahead because they're preparing for a county championship that only includes that county.
Yeah, no, I completely get you. And I know from our own situation down here, you're just seeing you're in a rural community with not many people around. You think what would be the harm in opening the pitch? What I was thinking there when you were going through the counties, for example, if you took a county like Kildare, for example, where there might be urban areas close to Dublin, so where in an urban area, maybe like a Tyre Leixlip, where they mightn't be permitted to open up a pitch, you know, or the whole county mightn't be permitted to open up a pitch, whereas a local club. To a local club in rural Kildare.
But don't talk within counties now. Look, if a tie has cases, then no club in the county, you know, or if leaks slip. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if the entire county has no cases for 14 days, then that county should be allowed, you know, open up their pitches.
Yeah, I suppose the point I was making is that a small club within the county might feel discriminated against if there was no, you know, cases in their area. I mean, getting really bogged down in minutia there, but I suppose...
You're definitely getting bogged down in it. John Horan says no.
Can the GAA mandate counties to make their own decisions? I think that gets very tricky. I think that's why they're probably...
They've all got autonomous county boards that decide on the playing competitions and the structures within their county.
I know. But this is considered a more national issue. This is just my take on it, Willie. I definitely know where you're coming from.
John Horan says no anyway. So he's quoted as saying, when put to him about, you know, certain counties being able to open back up, it's across the association. We have to stay in this together. And the big challenges are probably more in urban areas, and I do understand that, and I do get a feel for the frustration, and people are contacting me about that frustration, but we have to make safe and prudent decisions going forward. But a safe and prudent decision for a county who's had no new cases will be to open up. And we know John Horan is a bit of a parish pump president in that he'll make sure Dublin isn't left behind in anything, but I don't know how much that kind of is weighing on his decision to, you know, to make sure every county has to be treated equal when they're absolutely not treated, you know, treated equal. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Did you see the Cushendall video, Conan? So the Antrim County Board is investigating this. So I saw this video. It's nothing. It breaks the rule. There's four lads running over and back on a GAA pitch, socially distanced. Four of them. If this club gets fined or gets in any trouble for this, it's just an outrageous joke.
Yeah, but what's the rules? That's what it comes down to. Like, it's just...
I don't think that's a fair rule. So I'm on the lines. I would advise any club in Ireland, I would advise clubs in Ireland, go out, back out kicking on your field now. Go out, climb in over the gate when nobody's looking.
But I could say, I don't think the black card's a fair rule and just drag somebody down and say, I don't agree with it. You know, it's like...
A lot of lads do it.
we don't agree with the rules a lot of the times, and a lot of the time they're applied really badly as well. And this is probably one case where the rule could be looked at, but it is the rule, and I think people should stick to it. That's what I mean. Once Cushendall do it, then... You know, do Glenorf just down the road, do they start doing it? And does, you know, then do Ballycastle look at that and then they start doing it? And even if they're just running on the pitch, they're doing something that they shouldn't be allowed to do, and they're getting a little bit of an advantage on that as well because they're breaking the rule.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw the video, but it looked like, you know, these kind of GAA pitches that's kind of around in an estate. You know what I mean? There's no railing around it. You just walk onto it. The temptation must be unbearable in situations like that. You have an O'Neill's ball in your house, the pitch is out there, and you can't swing one over from, 30 metres out. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And you're in North Antrim as well, thinking you'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah, it would be grand. And then there's some busybody video on the outside of their bedroom window. I think Cushion Doll, give them a break. We'll all be back soon. Let them off. That's what I say.
Let the boys play.
Yeah, let them play. Let them play. There's nobody harmed. Did you see the piece Malachy Clerkin had it today? And it was in the Independent as well. It's basically from a study. So it's a study commissioned by the GEA. It's shown Gaelic footballers spend an average. This is the headline. It's just such a bizarre headline that the headline I don't want to really talk about much, but I'll read the first line to give the context of it anyway. So a new study commissioned by the GEA has shown that Gaelic footballers spend an average of just 2.5 seconds within 2 metres of other players during matches. Now, that's more than one other player. So I can see where they're talking about there. You come in and out of, you know, groups and it's in and out, whatever. So this study drew an imaginary 2 metre circle around the feet of each player. It measured the amount and duration of incursions into that circle by other players. It doesn't account for time in dressing rooms or pre-game warm-ups. That's fair enough. So during games, the longest any one player tracked in the study spent in the company of another was 58 seconds. So you're picturing a cornerback, corner forward situation there. He's inside, a good cornerback who's doing his job. He's, you know, touch tight, whatever. Was 58 seconds. So, like, I mean, here's the one which I thought was the more relevant stat. Players were found to spend an average of 24.72% of games inside 2 metres of at least one other player. Now, I don't know, Connor, what you think. I would have thought that would have been a lot higher than that, that players would line up close to each other. You know, full back lines, full forward lines, you'd imagine, would be within the 2 metres for a very high percentage of the game. Midfielders a lot less. And depending on how you direct your half back line, you know, from kickouts, you'd imagine they'd be beside each other. I don't know. I just expected that figure to be a lot higher.
Yeah, I would have thought the same. Like, it comes back to, I remember hearing that, like, a stat like a couple of years ago about the amount of time that an individual has a ball in their hands, you know, in a game, and it was under a minute, and you think, God, geez, you play for an hour and you know. You might have the ball in your hand for like 30 seconds. It seems really strange. I thought the same here because, you know, like, first of all, you know, if you're a cornerback worth your salt, you're going to be touch tight for, you know, you'd like to think 70% of the game, unless your man goes wandering off, you know. Half back lines a little bit less, as you said. Midfielders maybe a little bit less again, but there would be a lot of kind of individual duels for kickouts and stuff like that, where midfielders would have to be close to each other as well. So, yeah, I found that 24.7, just under 25%, is it? Yeah, a little low. But again, the thing was, you know, the main thing I took out of that was that 2.5 seconds within 2 meters of other players. I thought that would be dramatically higher.
Really? Sure. I suppose at what point are you kind of touch tight with more than one player?
Oh, sorry. That's just one. I thought that was just one player. Sorry, as opposed to more.
No, it has to be more than one. That 2.5 is more than one.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. Well, I suppose that would be just maybe, you know, kind of maybe duels around the full forward line or around midfield and breaking ball and stuff like that.
Yeah. But, so you're coming in and out. That's the way you read it, Conan.
Yeah, I think it's probably natural that you're getting less than we expect at county level because it's so fast and players are running at the average. Arsenal United did a study last year, 2 years ago, and the average running distance 9.2 kilometers. So I was thinking in a club game, it's going to be like, you know, that stat's going to go up. You're going to be more encountered with people, I think, because the game's slower and there's more passengers as well. Like, you know, there's people standing around watching the game. There are more fights, you know, so it's just, I think it's naturally you're going to be more, more encounters of people where you're inside, they're 2 meters. And then, like, yeah, you mentioned the change rooms, like shutters, water bottles, all the old habits that you have then with playing. Like, that's going to be probably the biggest problem, not being on the pitch. It's stuff that's happening in the change room and the warm up. Like, you spend more time hitting off boys in warm ups than you would in the match.
Yeah. But I suppose that's the thing that has to change. They did some study on training as well, and the figures are higher for training. And that's obviously, you do a drill, you get in a huddle. You do a drill, you get in a huddle. You know, you all share water, all those kind of things where it's a little bit more dangerous. I think practice is the dressing room before the match. So when you're looking at training, yeah, and even for matches, people are just going to have to arrive separately. You know, I'd say training will, if to do it right, you'd have to split training into maybe three groups and, you know, maybe line them up apart to talk to them. You know, backs and forwards might have to train separately. But the idea of the huddles, you bring your own water, you know, the idea of a dressing room scenario, all those things I'm sure will be in this pathway and that we're going to learn. But like, massive habits are going to have to change, Connor.
Yeah, I think so. And I'd like, just selfishly, I was thinking as well that like it probably means an end to those monotonous, torturous tackling drills. So, and just as I'm coming to the end of my career, but anyway, it's gonna even the thought of, I was just thinking there about how it's gonna manifest itself in training, and a lot of training, you know, you spend stuck behind a guy in a drill waiting to take your turn. Do you know that?
Yeah. You'd be lined out. It'd be like you're going into Lidl when you're lining up for a drill.
Yeah, so unless they can outline, you know, 2 meter distances on the pitch, you're going to have an end to that as well, which is probably no harm. But that's it. Like, it might lead to a revolution, like a good revolution in kind of training, that, as you said, there's a lot of back specific, you know, midfield specific, forward specific, and then you try and gather it together in a game on a big pitch, you know, kind of later on in the training session or something like that. But it'd probably mean an end to a lot of drill based stuff.
Yeah, a lot of managers' egos will be hurt where they can't get you into huddles talking nonsense the whole time as well. One huddle.
They're the two worst things. Like, you both mentioned, like, Conor, queuing up to get a kick of a ball, and then you have to queue up again for another minute and get another kick. And then, like, yeah, getting called in the huddle in the middle of the training. Like, you know, if those two things go, that is absolutely positive. And if you look at American football trainings, like, you know, they're like, Conor mentioned having backs and forwards and, you know, specific style training. Like, that's the way they do it. They spread out around the pitch. They're all doing different drills. The only problem with that, it's coming back to an urban problem, is you don't often get the pitch to yourself. You're sharing it with somebody else, sometimes two other teams, so you don't have enough space to sort of spread out around.
Could you see a situation, I'll ask you this, Conan, because I'm going to use an example, some little bollocks of a cornerback and he's marking his man and he starts coughing. Like, could you see somebody going that low? And I'm not usually one that thinks up of doomsday scenarios, but I know you like to, Conan, and I'm going to pick a county completely at random, like, say, Tyrone, where this might happen, right? But could you see a cornerback in Tyrone starting to cough to put his man off?
Yeah, I can. Yeah,
but that's so desperate that, like, I mean, I think this needs to be legislated for. Or, like, I mean, you know, there has to be some sort of deterrent for something awful, pathetic. Like, the future of the club championship could depend on some bollocks like that doing something like that.
But, like, that's, like, you know, there are almost worse things that's already happening, even though, like, this could potentially be a life and death scenario. But, like, you know, it needs to be legislated for people slagging their families, or, you know, bringing up people that are dead, or, like, you know, if somebody running in off the pitch, like, and this isn't all Tyrone specific, by the way, I'm thinking a lot about Derry as well, and all over the country outside Ulster, but, like, there's just a lot of shit that goes on. Like, whites, I'd like to think that, well, definitely, like, the vast, vast, vast majority of people won't go there at all, and they'll all be in it together and whatever, like, and maybe this thing has helped us, but somebody will do it. Like, you know, that's just the nature of some players and some teams. And yeah, there's just been too many bad examples, especially recently, to think that something like that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I think to do something like that and jeopardise, you know, the future of the club game and the intercounty game for this year would be just, it would be, I think it would be on a scale worse than anything that, you know, players could do. So just please don't do it. That's all I would have to say. Right, boys, continuing with our series of coaching. Now, this is coaching in the loosest of terms. Last week we did the art of fielding with Kevin Feely. This week we're going to discuss the art of trash talking. I'm not sure this really fits into coaching, but you never know. One of the finest exponents of the skill joins us on the line now. Eamon McGee, how's it going?
How's it going, Willie? I'm not too sure about that introduction.
Well,
we'll just go with it here.
Here's the first question. Were you always a good trash talker, or did you have to develop the skill?
I'd say it's something I had to develop, you know, in terms of how to be the biggest prick you could be. it's something that you had to work on. And to be honest with you, it wasn't. It didn't come naturally. It didn't come naturally, definitely not.
Didn't it? So, like, I mean, for me, the perception of Donegal getting involved in the trash talking was when Jim McGuinness took over. It was almost like he wanted a harder edge, and he saw a lot more kind of that stuff, verbals going on during matches.
Yeah, and you know, it's definitely something that probably came to the fore. There was always an element, and probably an element to every Gaelic team, that, you know, cynical nastiness, but it was definitely something that we talked about as a group, whether you had the Armaghs and the Tyrones, you know, doing whatever they had to do to win. And we had to take that we had to take that lesson on board and probably just, you know, we just were cynical, nasty, whatever you want to call us.
Yeah, all sorts of. So, like, I mean, a lot of those matches involve kind of, you know, the scuffles where you're holding each other's jerseys, and that's when the most of the trash talking happens. You know, during those flashpoints, is it constant?
It you know, for me, that's the way I always say you're marking the danger man. So you're beyond Sean Kavanagh or whatever. You probably the big tall man, because I was never put on the small fast fella. I was just too slow. I was put on the big tall fat fella. And it was always the case that I wanted to try and get at the confidence straight away.
Right.
Because, you know, it was never a case of, you know, personal jabs. They always felt that there was no need to bring personal stuff in it. It was just always to go at the confidence, go at the player's confidence. And forwards just thrive on confidence. And you're trying to sap away at that. And you're trying to, you know, a wee jab about whatever. Like, he might have took too many steps. He might have had a wee wide there, or, you know, just made a mistake. And you're always at him just to reinforce that he's made a mistake, and, you know, just to get the idea planted in his head that he needs to lose a bit of confidence. So for me, you know, you said the silly stuff, this ridiculous, you know, this holding jerseys. This, when you look at it now, it's the silliest thing ever, because it's the most pointless thing. Everybody's pushing and holding jerseys, and, you know, There's stuff said over and back, and that wasn't really planned. But the stuff when you're in marking your man, when you're in the corner and you've, you know, 2 minutes to burn. So rather than just sit there in silence, you know, you say, geez, that was a bad miss, the last one, or you're not going too well today. And, you know, I always laugh at the Dublin, the bench was, you know, ridiculously strong. So I was marking O'Gara one day, and I knew that Mannion was pushing for spot, and you had McManaman there, and this is Martin O'Gara, and this is Jesus Mannion warming up there now. You need to buck up here, wee bit on. And he looked over the sideline just to see was he actually warming up. So I knew that I was playing this mind, but no, it was always in the quiet moments in the corner.
Right, so that's the kind of get inside. And I suppose, but you're setting yourself up for a fall then, obviously, if O'Gara gets a goal then, or Kavanagh gets a goal, you're putting the head down, and I'm sure they're roaring back in your face or trying to get you back.
That's the thing. If you're everybody's watched the George documentary, and, you know, I was laughing away that everybody can fucking trash talk. Everybody can trash talk when they're 5 points up or 6 points up, and, you know, in your face and say, well, whatever. When you're starting off with a game, that's when you kind of takes a bit more balls to do, and you leave yourself open that you could turn around, you could get skinned. You know, you can start knocking in the first 2-3 minutes, and he has 1-5 scored off you after 20 minutes, you're gone, and he's saying, you know what I must say now, and that's the risk you take, because you can. It can flip on you. You can get at their confidence, but you can also give them motivation. So it just depends what kind of player you're dealing with.
Well, that's the thing, because I marked Ricey before, McManaman, in a league game, and he never opened his mouth to me, and that threw me off more than if he had been in my ear, because I knew the reputation he had. And then I was thinking, it's only a league game. This was after the game. I wasn't playing well. I'd say the man just thought in his head he didn't need to trash talk me. Like, I mean, maybe he held that off for better players in championship matches. But, like, I mean, I suppose it's finding out who he told me after. He says he didn't think it would work on me or whatever. So he obviously had analysed potentially players that it could potentially infuriate or get inside their heads. Like, I know he used to really get inside Brendan Devaney's head.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I would make a conscious effort of, like, you go out to mark Kieran Donaghy. Like, Kieran Donaghy, for me, I just felt there was no point, so I never even bothered with it, and just maybe got into a bit more physical, or often turned into one of them wrestling matches, and there was no point me going at him, because he was kind of strong mentally. It wouldn't really affect him. It would probably give him that wee bit of more motivation, and there was players like that where you just said there's just no point. There was no, there's players that were so in the zone that they just didn't pay any heed to you. And you know, you probably annoyed yourself more then when you're trying to say stuff and this big long list, and he's not even listening. He's like,
so, like, you mentioned Sean Kavanagh, and it was the 2015 championship that, like, Donegal Tyrone was toxic at that stage, and there was the, you know, a bit of a row going in, and you and Kavanagh were at each other, and you were probably in his ear. Did you think you could get inside Kavanagh's head, or did he lose the head with you at that stage going in, or did you overstep the mark?
No, I, with Kavanagh, you could, like, he would react, and that's all you're looking for, is a kind of right. reaction to see. But he would just keep coming back. Like, you could never. I remember I had him in 2016 and, you know, kept him quiet for the first half and chipping away at him. And he comes out and he scores 2 wonder points. And that's the thing about Kevin. You could never keep him down. With other players, they would start off like there was a graph and they'd just gradually go to the bottom. With Kevin, he always had the ability just to spike back up again. We never, to be honest with you, it was very rare, counting one hand probably the time, where it really got, all the times in Mark plays, it really got personal or it really kind of went over the edge. And I always felt that it was, when things weren't going for well for me on the field, like that it was just, that's when I started reacting or throwing stuff out that shouldn't be brought anywhere near a football field. Like, and
yeah,
that's kind of the thing, when you straddle that line, be it physically or cynically or whatever, inevitably you're going to cross it one or two times.
Well, that's the thing. There's a bit of comedy about what you're doing. If somebody misses a point, you're in their ear, you're not playing well, the sub's going. There's no real honour in bringing up personal stuff. And you hear all these stories about teams doing, like, I've heard it about Tyrone more so than any other county, about doing homework on teams and knowing stuff about them personally. Have you any experience with that? I never had any experience of anything like that at inter-county level.
You know, there was stuff said at the county level on me that there was research had to have been done, like it was just not nice stuff.
Really?
Definitely. But it's been rare. I've heard stuff about managers and coaches. It's more prevalent in the club game, but I've heard in the county manager going around asking for information, looking for information on opposition players, you know, personal information. I just think it's absolutely ridiculously. If someone says something personal and takes it to, like, I would have no bother, you know, plugging them after the game. I have no bother if one of my teammates brought up something personal and brought up something like that, then he deserves a slap after the game.
Yeah, no, it shouldn't be accepted. There's no doubt about that. And, like, I mean, there's no, like I said, there's no honour in that. Like, that's, it's, in a way, it's kind of cheating the game a little bit, isn't it? It's like, it's not.
Yeah, it's bullshit. I think there's just no need for it. It's probably laugh. I think the referee actually laughed at me as I says, "Ref, this man is after saying X, Y, and Z." And he laughed at me. "Are you seriously getting on to me about a player having verbals with you?" And I says, "Well, he's after saying something personal." And the ref just told me to cop on, like, so. But I was annoyed about it that I went to the ref and chatted about it, so.
Right. So, like, I mean, I suppose that's has trash talk got you to the point where you've lost control a little bit? Maybe not the personal stuff, because that's understandable. Like, I mean, have you been in a situation where you're doing a bit of trash talk and then you get hit for 1-2, he turns the tide on you and now you're completely rattled?
Yeah. The whole it's been role reversal. So instead of his confidence just on the way down, he's my confidence on the way down. You know, then you're keeping a close eye on the bench to see is there any defenders warming up for. It's just all about the confidence, really. That's the eye of the trash talking, is you're going for a man's confidence.
If you look at the bench, if you look at someone warming up and it even crosses your mind it could be for you, you're better off put your hand up and say, "Look, I've had enough for today."
That's it. If you see a defender up when you're kind of sure that you're coming off, you're better off saying to your man, "Hey, listen, sorry about that. apologies for all that shite I was chatting."
So who's a good trash talker then in the forwards? Donaghy, I know Donaghy's a good one. And like you said, it doesn't work on him. Is that, give us an example of someone who's good and an example of someone who you could potentially get inside their head.
You know, it's funny, like, I'm not sure, but it's been a while since I was marking him, but Connolly was always a man that I felt that, you know, took the bait fairly handy in terms of verbals.
Right. He hit in 11, wasn't it?
No. It was Marty Boyle.
You were close to the action.
Yeah, I would have been at him throughout the game. And I remember in a league game, I think it was 2013 or 14, whatever year it was anyway, that I was at him again during the league. And he went out of his way to try and, you know, get one over me. And he got blown up for steps a few times. And I knew then that he'd taken the bit that he was getting annoyed about this. And, you know, he was pushing out. And he was just someone that, I think, as the years went on, he's matured a bit. And he's got a wee bit, you know, wise to it now. But probably someone that it didn't affect, you know, that was the Donaghy thing. And I don't remember too many forwards being coming back at you and saying stuff, you know, oh, you're a terrible footballer. Like, I remember the Tyrone lads were just used to say, let McGee have the ball. I used to pick up the kick outs and get loads of these possessions, and they were saying, let him have it.
That's terrible. That's worse than any trash talking, isn't it? Let him have it.
Yeah, you know, I was trying to, you know, do what Connolly did and prove him wrong, and you'd end up making a complete hens of the thing.
Yeah, they're probably the best. They're probably the best wind ups, not the most, you know, not the most obvious insulting ones. It's like more subtle ones.
Yeah. Is when you have the whole Tyrone forward line just saying, "Let McGee have it," and you're there saying, "These boys just think you're a terrible footballer."
It's a classic. Come here. How do you feel about the July resumption? We're looking at, I think, the 31st of July. It came out. Well, we're going to read about it on Friday or on Monday. So, light at the end of the tunnel.
Definite light at the end of the tunnel. It's you only realise how important it is until it's gone. And I've got a double whammy there. The creches are back, and now GA's back. So everything is bright and positive in my life right now.
You'll have time to go for a pint now if the pubs reopen.
Aye, the pubs will be open next week, and that'll be the three godsends. And no, it's good. It's good just to get back. I think, in fairness, they were being, I know we probably didn't agree with how cautious, but you just have to trust them and trust the process. And, you know, they've taken the right decision now, and hopefully we'll be full whack about club championship. But is it end of August or starting at the end of July?
The 31st of July. It's the last day of July. It's on a Friday night. I think they're all going to kick off then. So it's August and September will be the 2 months for the club. We were talking on the show earlier, Eamon, like, there has been no new cases in Donegal for 11 days. Like, I mean, how frustrating. I was reading Kevin Cassidy has to drive past the Guidoor pitch to go down to a green area. Like, how frustrating is it in a county that it's gone completely out of, you know, almost, or for 11 days, 12 days now, we've seen no new cases, and you can't swing over a score?
No, I understand what you're saying. We see the whole county more or less, you know, swinging back to normal and head back to normality. And probably one of the biggest outlets for you personally, how you train and, you know, your social point at the weekend, it's not opening. So it's kind of frustrating that way. And what annoyed me about the whole thing is that these WhatsApp messages, you know, are people still training, and you have to put up a picture of yourself training, and this is driving me bananas. So hopefully this comes to an end now.
Do you know, just before I let you go, do you know what kind of a club championship you're going to have? I presume just straight knockout, or have you got any information
straight,
on that?
Straight knockout. You know, they're asking about for opinions on what, is there any way we can give a bit of variance, maybe home and away in the first leg and then straight knockout. But it's, from my understanding, it's going to be straight knockout.
Right, okay, so listen, that's something you can look forward to. Come here, Eamon, thanks very much for taking the call, I appreciate it.
Willie, thank you, appreciate that, mate. Take care now.
I'd never be allowed to go off and eat a heap of shite like him, and go off a slob or whatever, like, I was always doing a bit.
All I remember is I thought I was going to get clobbered on the way in there. I threw the ball up in the air, I don't know, it was pure luck, no, in fairness, pure luck. It's fucking bullshit, as you've seen yourselves.
Okay, so Conor Myler had a piece on LinkedIn, which is a bit of a strange one. I think he writes. What's that all about, actually, Conor? Is LinkedIn paying him to write articles, or how does that work? Or am I throwing something at you that you don't know anything about?
No, he's just got his own LinkedIn page, and he's sticking up sort of like a blog post. It's, people use Medium, some people use LinkedIn. It's just if you're not writing on a published website, you can just publish it on there and stick it out.
Right.
He's writing good pieces, in fairness to him.
Yeah. So this was a good piece about Michael Jordan. And suppose you'd be sick in the teeth kind of listening about Michael Jordan and that clip that went out and went viral about, you know, you either want to win or, you know, you don't. And yeah, I wasn't very nice to my teammates, but I wanted to win, etc. And all this kind of thing. And then you have a whole lot of people saying, no, you don't have to be an asshole to be a good leader. And all these kind of arguments. And Conor Myler's saying that you don't have to be like him. He says, are there other ways to lead successfully? And he says, the answer is yes. My worry for coaches, parents, and even athletes themselves is that they will watch The Last Dance and try to emulate Michael Jordan's mindset and impose it onto their care. And impose it onto those in their care. The truth is, no matter how much you try, you can't be Michael Jordan. And I don't know. Do you really think people, Conan, will start to copy someone after watching a documentary from the 90s?
Absolutely. Like, we're talking about those huddles that we get into. Like, how many times does somebody speak up and, like, you know, somebody who's probably a sub for most of their career and they're telling you they need to do better? And, like, you know, people love that opportunity anyway to speak up. And
a sub can't relate to Michael Jordan. Like, let's be honest, there's only certain players who can get away with being an asshole like Michael Jordan. And you're looking at Messi, you're looking at Ronaldo, you're looking at players that teammates know. I don't care what he's like. We need him. He's unbelievable. He is the greatest player in this game. Any random player can't do that. And any random player can't pretend their personality is like Michael Jordan's. And even if it is like Michael Jordan's and they're this kind of alpha male and they come into a dress room and they like to take the piss out of lads, if they're not as good as Michael Jordan, they'll be told to piss off.
Yeah, but you're right. Like, that's what I was going to say. So, like, there's only three people that I can think of in the history of team sport who would be able to get away with that. And it's the three people you mentioned, Jordan, Messi, and Ronaldo, is because they back it up and because they're so, so far ahead of every one of their teammates that it's grand. Like, they're all going to put up with it because he is so far ahead. And also, like, he needs them to get up a level so he can win what he wants to win. It's selfish, like, as well. They want to achieve, but they need their teammates to help them. So they can get away with it. Like, other people will try it. I think they will. Like, they'll naturally sort of pick up those habits that won't work because they're not Michael Jordan or Messi or Ronaldo, and they won't get the respect. Like, so, like, you might pick up some decent things from it, like, and maybe standards will raise across the board, but nobody can go on like Michael Jordan unless they're Messi or Ronaldo. You know, it's just not possible.
I remember I captained Portlaoise, not to give an own analogy in this context, but, like, I mean, and Portlaoise, I'm in the top two or three players on the team. And I really, you know, I did give out to lads a lot. For Leash, I would never do that because I wouldn't have the standing in the team to do it. Like, it's showing a serious lack of intelligence. If you watch that and you're a club player, and you think, Conor, that you can start going around like Michael Jordan, I just don't think lads will do it. I think this has been overly analysed. And another thing is, Conor, like, you know, that kind of leadership worked in the 90s. We're 20 years on now. Players are much more sensitive. You see managers like Jose Mourinho with kind of management styles that worked 20 years ago or whenever, 15 years ago when he started. It just doesn't work now. Players are rebelling against it. So even if Michael Jordan was to come back now and start that with a basketball team now, you'd have players crying and looking to transfer.
Yeah, no, like,
we're softer now.
You've hit the nail completely on the head, like, as in that the reason that Jordan could get away with it, the reason that Messi or Ronaldo, I don't know that they're dickheads, like, you know, in the dressing room, whatever, but because
Ronaldo is,
you get that impression, yes, because they back it up all the time, and they have the stats and they have the performances to prove it. Like, my only kind of thing on this is that, like, I've found over the years that the GAA has a bit of a copycat mentality. So, like, I think there's a lot of characters in dressing rooms throughout the country that will see that and look to adopt that immediately, and they'll be telling their teammates that. So, you know, like even Conor Myler's post, he mentioned that, like, this is different because it's collective. But Conor Myler mentions the All Blacks no dickheads culture. And, like, look how pervasive that became in the GAA, yeah, where everybody sweeping the sheds and stuff like that. You know, like, the only thing I suppose is that, like, The Last Dance has been over for about a month now. So by the time that we're back playing club football, the people might have forgotten about it. But I reckon that if club championship was taking place at the moment, you can guarantee that there'd be clubs up and down and individuals, players up and down the country echoing what Michael Jordan said and justifying the fact that he did it for them to get away with it, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. And anyways, that All Blacks no dickheads thing, that's the greatest load of nonsense. You might as well be in the army. You're trying to suppress people's personalities. People should be allowed to be themselves and the manager should manage different personalities. This no dickheads thing is basically everybody act the same. Nobody step out of line. If you're not humble, pretend you're humble and come in and come into the dressing room like a bloody actor.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretend you're humble, Wooly, but make sure you get filmed while you're sweeping the dressing room.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's heard Jordan Henderson on Jamie Carragher's podcast, and if you think of the Suarez at Liverpool, he was way above everybody else at Liverpool, but Henderson talked about having a blow up of him at training because Suarez was basically going on like Michael Jordan was going on in some of the examples. Suarez is throwing his hands up every time Henderson had the ball and sort of poking at him, looking over to the coaches saying, what's he doing? And they came head to head apparently, and Henderson wasn't having it from Suarez, who was way above him and everybody else, so it didn't even work there. It's not going to work at club level GAA. I can see, Wooly, definitely you're coming in from county, and I when a county player's in the squad and they are raising the standard and stuff like that. But part of me is also thinking, some boys here just want to train twice a week and play a match. They're not going to be doing what the county players expect of them nearly. There's one healthy thing there, I think, from Michael Jordan's little bit where he said, I didn't ask anybody to do anything I didn't do myself. That's probably just the most important thing anyway. If anybody's going to take anything from that clip, it should be that, lead from what you're doing.
Well, that's the thing. So Jordan, not only he was an alpha male, it was his personality, and he was a competitive freak, and he trained harder than everybody else, and he was better than everybody else. So if he wants to give out to you, what are you going to come back to him with? There's nothing really to come back to him. So yeah, he took advantage of that and maybe was a bit of an asshole. But at the same time, I'm taking it on. I remember an interview with Wayne Rooney saying Ronaldo didn't really work, so I just worked a little bit harder for him because he might score the goal. Every team has hierarchies. I hate this no dickheads, everybody's the same policy. They're not. They're absolutely not. It's just not the way the world works. And I don't know any kind of team or job or any walk of life where everybody has to act the same, have the same personalities.
I've long had issues with that no dickheads thing, Wooly. I've said them on the podcast at all, and I've especially an issue with how they seem to have been adapted throughout the GAA. Do you know what I mean? Even we've talked about it over the years as well. Maybe the Dublin players being told not to celebrate goals and stuff like that, and the way they maybe conduct themselves in interviews a certain way that it has to ascribe to a certain protocol or something like that, which it just. It tempers individuality, it tempers flair, and it tempers personality and charisma. And I wouldn't be a fan of it whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. So there's going to be a new club in East Belfast, lads. And if you ever wondered how easy it is or hard it is to set up a club, well, this seems pretty easy. So Dave McCreevy, who is from Down and played in the 2013 Connacht final, he was playing with London. He was eating breakfast one morning and he set up a Twitter account at East Belfast, I think it is. And he tweeted out a new GAA club for East Belfast, not a GAA stronghold by any means. Anyways, a new GAA club for East Belfast. If you're interested in playing, coaching or admin, more than likely all three, all ages, genders and backgrounds welcome. Please email the email address. And he said within a half an hour, the response was crazy. His phone hasn't stopped. Thought we'd get enough for an under 12 boys team, but at this rate, it looks like we're going to have a men's team, a ladies football team, a hurling team, and hopefully a camogie team. So there's been 100 people expressing interest in joining the club, and 45 have said they're interested in playing either men's, women's, or hurling or camogie. So it still doesn't fix where they're going to play or what they're going to do. There's a lot of answers, and they're looking to play in the Down Championship as well, Colin. So I don't know if you're our Ulster correspondent.
I'm not sure why they're Belfast does run a bit into Down as well, a bit of it, but East Belfast wouldn't. And I think it would be a great. It would be a great statement almost to do it in interim with all the other Belfast clubs. And East Belfast is a predominantly unionist area, so it would be great, like, you know, just to have a GAA club there. And I just was thinking about the example of Nivena, who got the Ulster final a couple of years ago, intermediate. Like, they're in Glengormley, and they've had their own troubles down through the year just because of where they're based, and they're a GAA club. But, like, what a community it is for everybody who you're Gales in that area. Like, and this could be great for people in East Belfast.
Yeah, so I think the last time there was a GAA club in that area was the 1970s, St. Colum Kills. They went out of existence, like I said, in the early 1970s. So that's a great thing. Yeah, just the question of why the Down Championship would be much better to compete in the Antrim Championship, and where the hell are you going to train? I suppose maybe Colum Kills. Well, no, I wouldn't say that's just sitting idle for the last 50 years. Anyways, we might get Dave McCreevy on the show on Monday to have a chat about that. Another one here quickly, lads, is a tweet from Kieran Sheen. And this is another thing that kind of grinds my gears is, John Fogarty had a piece in the Examiner, and he said, focused athletes as they are, or says, inter-county players can't be expected just to switch off. The sad reality is they're being deprived of what defines many of them. Now, Kieran Sheehan took exception to this and said, this is a concern for me. Players shouldn't be defined by a sport they excel in. What happens to the athlete when their career ends? Better life, better performance. And all this thing of being defined by the sport that you play. I played GAA for how I'm still playing. So I'm playing GAA maybe 30 years, and I have never once had a conversation with a GAA player about whether the sport defines them or not. Is this just a made up kind of overthinking kind of thing, Conan, or what is it? Like, I mean, I've never spoken about it. And like, to be known as a good Gaelic footballer, why are you trying to say that's a bad thing? It's a good thing. And if you overthink your life and you're trying to think, oh, well, but is that all I have? Well, that's up to you to change that. Like, I mean, being known as a good intercounty player is a pinnacle of Gaelic football, and you should never see that as a bad thing. And I just don't really get this whole conversation. Please explain it to me.
Yeah, I get the concern. Like, you know, people want to show that there's more to them than just that. And maybe sometimes they don't have that opportunity if they're being asked to not speak to the media, or especially if they're only being asked questions about GAA as well when they're in the media. But yeah, it's a good thing. Like, surely, like, if you've given up, as you say, like 30 years of your life to play GAA, like, do you not want to be associated with it in some way? And, like, yeah. You look at, again, just not to use you as the only example here, but, you know, it's been great for you. Like, you've went to America mm-hmm. and played. Like, you've played for Ireland International Rules. You've got a career now where you're talking about GAA. And I always think, like, I look at, like, somebody like Carragher, who I mentioned there, Gary Neville. Like, they're using their past examples. They're using what we see that defines them as footballers, as yeah. being good now at being pundits, and it's a good career for them.
Well, have you ever had a conversation with a teammate going, geez, I feel like I'm being defined as a GAA player? Are these regular conversations that happen that I've just never heard in 30 years?
Do you know what? In fairness, I might have had, like, a internal thought where I just feel like my whole life is being dictated by it. But I don't...
But that's different.
It is different, isn't it? Like, because, like, you're right. If you want to portray someone else, then just do it.
Exactly, Connor. It's up to you to live the life that you want to live. And, like, I mean, here's another thing, right? I'm a doctor. I'm an inter-county GAA player, to use the example. How do you know you're being defined as a GAA player? A GAA player is much more high profile in your life than being a doctor. You're not a famous doctor that plays in front of 70,000 people. Like, how much of a balance between... How much definition, you know, do you want between your career and your intercounty much more high profile pastime?
Yeah, that's what depends on how high profile a doctor you are, Willie. But I don't know too many doctors that are that high profile that their profile as a doctor exceeds that as a GAA player. But
exactly. So that's all. The higher profile intercounty game is you're going to be known for that regardless of other stuff. When I see Kieran Sheehan, for example, am I defining him as that? I'm not really. I know him as it, but I don't know what he does. You know, well, we had him on a show, but I don't, a lot of intercounty players, you don't know what to do with the rest of their life. And I don't overthink it by going, Jesus, I only know him as a GAA player. You know, I don't know.
But how else are you? How else is me, say somebody from Mayo, supposed to know Kieran Sheehan apart from as a GAA player? Do you know what I mean? But the danger here is like is applying that mindset collectively. Some people are absolutely happy to be, you know, to be caught up in their identity as a GAA player. It's probably defined their whole life, their relationships. They might have met their, you know, long term partner. Their career might have got a job through the GAA. They're, you know, they might be involved in GAA long after they finish playing. They might be happy with that. Whereas there's others who might be, you know, completely immersed in GAA throughout their career, and then find that when they stop playing, you know, that they struggle to deal with life because their life isn't the same when they're still playing. But it's completely individualistic. It's really difficult to apply, you know, the issue of identity as a GAA player to everybody. So yeah. I suppose that's like we've tried to hit at it there, but that's, some people are happy to be identified as GAA players, and some players would prefer something else to be identified about them first. It's up to the individual to decide what that is.
Well, yeah, it is. And one other thing, though, is during my 20s, I worked in finance. I wasn't happy in that job at all. Being an intercounty footballer is what brought joy to my life. Not the, like, I being defined as a Gaelic footballer was a good thing in my life. Being known as a good player was a good thing in my life. Like, a lot of people are glad that they're intercounty players. I hate this idea that that's wrong to be defined by that. Or only, you know, not everybody has a brilliant job that they're really proud of. Like, but they could be they're really proud of their sporting ability.
Yeah, and interestingly, like, I've never been or seen Kieran Sheehan on a date or whatever, but if he was out talking about himself, like selling himself or whatever, he would maybe talk about his career first. This is what I do. I'm from Cork. And then, like, surely, like, the next topic or somewhere near the next topic would be, I play GAA at a very high level, because this is where it's worth spending a lot of my time, and I'm actually really proud of the achievements that I've taken in.
No, I don't want this to be. I don't want
the word wrong. Yeah, I don't want it.
I don't want it to be a criticism of Kieran Sheehan, because I see it a lot these days, you know. And Dermot Ling, Gizzy, and he's a really, really deep thinker. And there's a bit of a GPA element to this as well, of not being defined by it. And maybe if it's to encourage you to do some, you know, to get a job that you like, but that's not the reality for most, you know. It's something that kind of bothers me when I read it. I don't want it to be a criticism of Kieran, you know. Like, I mean, it's like Connor says, it is each to their own, I suppose. And if it pisses him off that somebody says, oh, there's Kieran Sheehan, the Cork footballer, that's his business. But I would say he'd be well in the minority of that.
I wonder, is there a difference, like, are they thinking that by somebody saying that this defines them, do they think that's just encapsulating them then? Like, you know, this is the only thing that they do, and that's what everybody thinks. And maybe, that's where maybe
they're overthinking it. This is my point.
Yeah.
Just get on with it. Grand, you're a good player. Yeah.
Just like, get on with it with Colin Parkinson on the podcast.
All right, lads. Our last one of the day is Owen Merchant. Like, I mean, I've never met Owen Merchant. I like him as a player. And this is kind of modesty gone wrong here, right? Because I laughed when I read this, and he's talking about his All-Ireland goal. And this is really a classic. Now, he explains it after, so I'm just going to have a little bit of a laugh at the first part of it and then talk about it a bit more seriously. So he says, I got the easy end of the job, which was putting the ball in the back of the net. An individual goal that basically nobody else touched from a set play. This lad ran from midfield to stick it into the corner of the net, and he got the easy end of the job, which is putting it. No one else did anything outside of getting out of your way, Owen. Like, I mean, I was like, what is this? He says, the finish is fine, it went in. I'm happy with that. But what's more impressive was with that play is the movement and the smart, the selflessness of the other guys on the pitch. I can kind of see where he's coming from there. Like, obviously, Conor Callaghan and Dean Rock kind of spread out of the way. This is like Maradona in 86 in the World Cup saying, oh, geez, I'd really like to thank my teammates for showing up on the day, because, you know, it would have been a walkover if I hadn't they hadn't have shown up. So I want to thank them for just being on the pitch.
I'd like to thank David Warren for pointing the ball straight to me. Yeah, the only other thing is that they all spread out, yeah, as you said, but the halfback line also got dragged out for the throw-in, which is clever. Like, if you pause it from behind the nets, they're all at the 65-metre line because the half-forwards have gone out for the throw-in. That's it. Like, Merchant did everything.
It still wasn't the easiest part of the job.
No, it was not. That finish was incredible on the run like that. It was absolutely incredible goal. But here's an interesting thing about Merchant, and it was part of this interview as well. He was on some Zoom call, and He said he noticed, he said, I noticed in the first half I'd found myself in a lot of space, consistently in acres and acres of space. As we were coming out of the tunnel, I had a word with Johnny Cooper and just said, look, at some point I'm just going to have a go. Isn't that like, I mean, the more I think about it, and I've always said this, that managers need to, you know, get the feedback from their players about what they see on the field, because there's no better analysts of games than, nobody else knows the midfield area than halfbacks, half forwards, and who, you know, who's on top of the breaks. You get your stats man in all you want, but they know what's happening and how it's happening. That he had a good idea that he was going to get a chance like that in acres of space, and he had his mind made up pretty much, Connor, that I'm just going to go for it. So when that happened, you know, it wasn't crazy for him. He kind of had it in his mind. If that, for example, if that happened from the first half throw in, he would have passed that off to Conor Dean Rock. You know, he would have forced him to come on the loop.
And isn't it brilliant that he didn't play in a system where, like, as a halfback, whatever, he wasn't prevented from going beyond the halfway line, which is, you know, if a manager had said that to him, he might have thought twice about it. And that, like, it nearly seemed to be, I'm sure, like, that obviously came from Owen Merchant's experience in the first half, that he was going to have a go. But I thought it was brilliant that he just said it to Johnny Cooper. Maybe he thought he had to say something to somebody just in case he did do something. He said, I told you I was going to do that. But he said it just as they were coming out of the tunnel at halftime as well. But I always got the impression, and like Anthony, you hear about Dublin players as well, is that like they were empowered to think for themselves. I mean, you often hear stories about the Dublin team just, you know, when they came in at halftime and they mightn't be playing particularly well, and Jim Gavin just let them have it amongst themselves for 10 minutes and decide what to do, because he had so much trust in them as a group of players that he knew they could make the right decisions. So, like, yeah, it's just really, really refreshing to hear it from somebody like Owen Merchant as well, who, like, without knowing the inside of the Dublin dressing room, you imagine probably wouldn't be the most vocal either.
Yeah, probably not. He said, I thought somebody, Con or Dean, would come to me and try and take the ball off me, but that just never happened. I just kept going. Eventually, there was no one to give the ball off to, so I just had to go for it myself, Conan.
you talked before, Willie, about Dublin playing against Mayo and feeling the strength of the Mayo players, you know, when they're coming into the tackle, so they pull back out. That's the difference when they're playing against other teams who don't have strong defenders. And just that idea of players giving feedback to managers, like a manager can't know that. He can see who's playing, he can see if they're tight or not, but he can't know if the player is feeling particularly strong or you don't want to go at him. Like, you know, whereas a player will know who you can go at and who you can't just based on what's happening minute to minute. And if he feels like somebody's just not up to it or he's got a soft shoulder, he's the best person to say that to the manager and say, well, we need to be a bit more ballsy and get at those three boys over there or isolate them. Or it's just things that a manager can't know from looking at the sideline.
Yeah, no, they're definitely, maybe not at half time because there's not enough time. But, you know, I'd say what Dublin are very good at is the post-match Monday night meeting where players can give their thoughts and they're encouraged to, you know, and then the management can get all that brilliant on the field information and, you know, make their decisions. And I think that's why Dublin were just so good coming from draws into the replays and usually made the right changes. We're finished. We're in good mood today. That's the thing. Like, I mean, I feel so much more enthusiastic. Watching an old All-Ireland was great crack for a while, and now analysing an old match, I'd just rather jump out the window of the office here.
Just get on with it, will you?
All right, maybe I'm overthinking it, right, which I hate. Right, okay, we'll talk to you Monday. We'll be back into the show on Monday. Talk to you then. Good luck.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I should go. And so I opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are. And we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today. Because, like, I'm heartbroken. I let it go, 'cause I won't see you later.